Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What professionals play a part in your child's chances of succeeding in school? While discussions about education often center on what takes place within the classroom, a really good school requires not only skilled teachers, but effective principals and superintendents with the power to motivate and support their efforts with students. So what qualities do those executives need? And is the existing system of postgraduate education working the way it should to train the next generation of education leaders? David Chard is dean of SMU's Annette Caldwell Simmons School of Education and Human Development. Reed Lyon is distinguished professor of educational policy and leadership at SMU. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with some definitions here. Who falls under the rubric of education leader?
Reed, do you want to take that?
There are leaders at every level, including the teacher. Obviously, the teacher is leading where the rubber meets the road. But the executive decisions are made, obviously, at a superintendent level. But when you look at who has the most impact on whether kids learn and achieve, that's at the principal level. Mm-hmm. The amount of management expertise and organizational expertise and motivational expertise that a principal must have that translates into how well kids actually learn and achieve is much more than anybody really realizes.
Mm-hmm. But to sort of round out your question, the answer to your question, I think you also have to pay attention to the fact that those people are then enabled by strong superintendents as well as members of school boards who are often members of the community, parents or grandparents who are working to try to improve their schools as well.
Well, to a certain extent, a manager is a manager, but are there special qualities that education managers need to have?
Oh, certainly. I think probably the management in a school setting goes beyond the management of adult personnel. That's one of the key pieces, is that you're working in an institution where you have children across a range of ages who are obviously not necessarily coming in with the same kinds of skills, the same knowledge about schools, the same sort of academic background. So you have this range of children who, on a good day, are kind of unpredictable. So the management goes beyond just managing adults who then come and go from work. You're also worried about transportation and materials. So absolutely, there are certain specialty skills related to school management.
And there are things that are within a principal's control and then things that are not. And it almost seems like the things that are out of his or her control outstrip the others.
Well, that may be the case. I hope that's not the case in the future. The more we can help people understand that if we're focused on how kids learn and how well they do, and if we can explain concisely and succinctly what the principal's role in doing that, that possibly will have an impact on how the public and the higher school officials have on what a principal needs to be able to do. David just brought up the organizational capabilities, but there are specific skills that principals need that far exceed what many executives have to exercise in business. They have to be not only motivators, but they have to understand the scientific research with respect to the programs they select. They have to know how to implement programs so that they sustain and scale. Education is extraordinarily vulnerable to magic bullets and the next thing down the pike and how fast everybody wants to see results. You have to have a very astute leader who knows their stuff in order to explain why that can't be the case. There are certain conditions under which programs and policies are best implemented and carried out. And sometimes those conditions aren't well known either to the public or to the principal.
Well, that's really interesting because, I mean, clearly a research-based curriculum is important to everyone who sort of values making sure that kids are being exposed to the best kind of learning they can get. Teachers sometimes will describe it as something akin to that scene in The Wizard of Oz where everybody's going to wear red one day and then everything switches and they're going to wear blue. Where's the balance and how do principals in particular have to communicate and make those decisions about when things are really going to change and when you need to step back and sort of wait a little bit? Mm.
Boy, you've asked a really important question, I think, and one that sort of reflects what Reed is talking about. School leaders are often, depending on a school district and the context they're working in, often have to make decisions about the programs they're going to implement without a lot of information. And so what those leaders need to bring to a school is a means of informing their teachers about what it is the features of those programs should be that do conform with research. And then they have to constantly be evaluating those programs because even though the research base may suggest that a program is effective, we may not know that the context in which it's being implemented in a particular school district is going to necessarily be where it was studied. And so there's sort of a role that the leader plays in evaluating those programs on a regular basis and then helping teachers make professional decisions about the best way to implement them.
Yeah, let me underscore that because it's a critical point. You can have the best instructional programs in the world, most evidence-based have found to be effective and extremely powerful. You can have the best teachers, best prepared teachers. You can even have the best materials and resources, great school, good budget. But if you do not implement appropriately what all of this good stuff is, you're going to get nowhere. You can have the best principal, the best teacher, but if you don't put it in place so it sticks and it sustains and you can scale it, then we're sunk. And when people ask me what it is about a principal that makes that individual different from a superintendent, for example, or from a business executive, it's on-the-ground responsibility for making sure that complex programs that have been shown to be effective are put in place and to know what the conditions are that make them effective and sustain over time. And there's a whole list of things that principal has to know. You know, for example, a big mistake we always make is not only the magic bullet mistake, but to put in something and expect it to take hold in the entire school the first year. When these things are so complex, they need to go into, obviously, two classrooms, get the noise out of it, tweak it, and so forth, then move it to a more comprehensive level. But we shoot ourselves in the foot on very common sense things. You're trying to help children learn and achieve. To be able to do that, they have to have good teachers and they have to have good programs. You blow the chance of ever putting that in place if you come at it too large.
What's the typical path by which someone gets into educational administration?
Well, typically you find teachers who have been in the classroom for a period of time. And in fact, states often have regulations about how many years they have to have been classroom teachers before they can move into a more advanced position in a school district. A period of classroom teaching, then a preparation program of some sort. And in Texas, we have lots of alternative programs as well as more traditional programs led by school districts or institutes of higher education. The interesting thing is that those are not in today's world, we're seeing an increasing number of atypical approaches. So people who are making career changes, coming from a CEO kind of role and moving into schools because they want to make a difference outside of the sort of private sector. And we're seeing more relaxed standards about how people come into the field in sort of leadership roles because we've had changes in the way we think about schools. Charter schools now are much more acceptable, and certainly private schools, which don't have the same level of regulation that public systems do.
Have you both observed that people can be effective principals if they haven't, say, spent a decade in front of a classroom?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you know, we constantly hear about the principal shortage. There's really not a principal shortage. Where we are lacking in terms of effective leadership are in inner city schools and rural schools. Frankly, some of those schools the most in need of strong leadership. That's why some of the alternative routes may be important, because we have to have some type of capability of providing very at-risk kids and very at-risk schools with people that know what they're doing. The question, of course, is, will alternative programs provide us leaders who know what they're doing? And that's a little hard to judge because we're fairly sure that colleges of education aren't doing what we need to be doing.
Well, that's a fascinating problem. It sounds like a set of Russian nesting dolls because you have the problem of evaluating how well students are doing, and then you have to step back and look at the schools that are trying to educate school leaders.
That's a good way to characterize it. And in fact, today we often talk about accountability systems for student achievement as though we've always had them. But this is a fairly new phenomenon in the United States. It really only the last 20 years have we seen the kinds of clearly defined standards and an effort to develop assessment systems to know whether or not schools are doing what we think they should be doing, which is educating our children. And states like Texas, which were really at the front end of that in developing standards and implementing an accountability system. And I want to throw in here, we're still adjusting how we do that. Listeners shouldn't think that we feel that we've got that figured out, but rather that we have a way of, in a standardized way, measuring whether or not schools are improving and whether their efforts are actually directed at the right kinds of features of their teaching and management and leadership that are resulting in student outcomes that we're interested in.
Given that, although I know there's a raging debate about this, that we essentially, for all practical purposes, assume that standardized testing tells us how well an individual student is doing and how well a teacher is doing, is it fair to extrapolate that and say the test scores within a school reflect, at least after a certain amount of time, how effective a principal is?
They can be one index of how well the principal is doing. But the focus, if that principal is strong in their approach to how well they can educate the kids, knows that one index of student achievement is not only not appropriate, it won't guide instruction, but that's the point. It does not guide instruction. Before that school assesses kids at the end of the year, the principal will have needed to have prepared his teachers to assess the kids on a continuous basis in each content area. So that, number one, assessment and testing becomes part of the learning itself. It's not onerous, and it also doesn't allow kids to make mistakes and continue to make the same mistakes. You know, good research explicates common sense. And if you and I are learning something and we don't seem to be able to get it, we may continue on in a confused state for 3 more weeks. If, in fact, the school culture is assessing the kids as we go along and we know if they're falling off the concept, then that assessment brings the teacher needed information, critical information, to adjust the instruction. Once you do that, that's the major focus of helping kids learn and achieve. The standardized formative measure at the end of the year is basically a measure of how well you've minded your P's and Q's throughout the year.
Yeah, and I also think there are a number of other variables that have to be talked about in response to your question. For example, how long has the principal been in the school? How many teachers are new? So there are lots of questions around professional development that focus on taking the school from perhaps being a low-achieving school to being an acceptable or high-achieving school. And that trend of progress is really important. So, yes, does the principal have an impact on student achievement, and should they be held accountable? I think there's little disagreement about that, but you have to give them time to right the ship if you're putting a principal into a school that's had a past, you know, history of difficulties.
My guests are David Chard. He is dean of the Annette Caldwell Simmons School of Education and Human Development at SMU. Reed Lyon is with us as well. He's distinguished professor of educational policy and leadership at SMU. We're talking today about the impact of educational leadership. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think On KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Reed Lyon, Distinguished Professor of Educational Policy and Leadership at SMU, and David Char, Dean of the Annette Caldwell Simmons School of Education and Human Development at SMU. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. How can administrators improve the quality, if they can, of the applicant pool for the teachers that they're putting into their classrooms?
Well, there are a number of things I think they can do. Again, lots of variables here. Where are you located? Are you in a desirable community where teachers want to teach? These are some of the things that play into that that issue. I think beginning to create a culture within the school that teachers want to work in has a big impact on whether or not there's an esprit de corps that prospective teachers want to come into. Creating partnerships with feeder schools, meaning schools where children proceed and follow, many times will cause teachers to work within that community, within those feeder schools. A number of variables that I think make places attractive to work in. And of course, you know, just the things that are attractive in any workplace, a culture where people are appreciated. And you know, teachers, like any profession, talk to one another, they network. And it isn't difficult to find a good principal by talking to the teachers that work for that principal and finding out that she is one of those people who creates a culture where your work is acknowledged and that you're provided the kind of support and professional development you need to be successful.
You know, I think that's exactly right. People have to work where obviously they're reinforced for what they do. But the question that I have is, how do we improve the talent pool that actually selects education mm-hmm. as a profession? One of the things that the consumers are going to have to do, whether that's the principal or the superintendent, the school board, or the public, is to say, we need teachers who are better prepared to address the complexities of their classroom and the tremendous number of differences in how the kids learn. Because that's what will blow a teacher out of the water, particularly a young teacher, is they come into a classroom and they expect in no way the different types of youngsters and how they learn and her need to differentiate instruction. So that's an issue. Now, clearly, this is what we do for a living. We prepare teachers and we prepare leaders, but we have to do better. If we look at the research, we know that 60 to 70% of teachers typically report that what they have learned in colleges of education has not been helpful in preparing them for the classroom. Even more alarmingly, 70% of principals report that the material and instruction they learned in their preparation programs was irrelevant and not related to their daily jobs. So we have to make sure we're preparing experts. Expert teachers, expert leaders. And, you know, we know how to do that. And what's so frustrating for David and I and others is there's this big gap between what we know and what is actually done.
It's part of the problem in terms of relevancy, the fact that sometimes teaching leaders and teachers what they will actually be able to use doesn't look very impressive when you sort of put it on a syllabus. You know, are there sort of practical matters that they need to be trained to undertake that somehow seem like they could be better spent studying something else?
Well, I mean, we have to be honest about the fact that typically as we prepare teachers, we get very little real estate in their university time to actually work with them to prepare them to be a teacher. So we're really given about a year for someone who's preparing at the postgraduate level. And if we're fortunate enough, we might get a year and a half if we're preparing someone at an undergraduate level to become a teacher. This is far too little time to really prepare someone to work with the variety of children they're going to work with in school. And so it's not just that what we're teaching them is, if we were to offer it as what they need, it would be too practical. It's just a matter of a lot needs to be learned in a very short period of time. And, you know, Reed's comment about the need to have more functional education for prospective teachers is that we need to get teachers and leaders closer to the children they're going to work with as we're preparing them. And that hasn't always been the traditional way of doing it. So we're seeing much more of an effort to get learning for preparation and application to be proximal to one another in the classroom, in the school, utilizing the tools that I'm taught on Monday, on Tuesday, so that there's no question about whether or not it's effective or not. I'm seeing it working or not working and can come back to a more knowledgeable faculty member or mentor teacher and say, I tried it, didn't seem to work. How could I have implemented it differently? What kinds of things can you tell me now to try? So I think it's more about having enough time to prepare a professional to work in a very, very complex environment that schools are, and also making sure that preparation is close to what they're actually going to be doing in the classroom or school.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Andy in Carrollton. Hello, Andy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious about your opinion on the role of technology and modern information systems and the role that can play in school reform. And I'll take my answer offline.
Thanks for your call.
It's a great question, because technology must begin to take a more formidable role in how we help kids. Here's the stark facts. If we want to close the achievement gap, that means if you take any content area, reading or math, and we have kids who are significantly behind, the amount of effort, expert teaching, and the intensity of that teaching that will bring that kid closer to proficiency is enormous. It's much more than people know. For example, if you have a kid who's at the 20th percentile in reading, which means they're not reading very proficiently, to move that youngster even to average is going to take probably 3.5 hours to 4 hours per day. Now, how can that be done? The teacher certainly, in the way we've structured education today, they can probably give the kid 1.5 to 2 hours. But here you've got this additional 2 hours that you must provide instruction. So how do you do that? And how do you do that so that the youngster isn't pulled away from activities they like and motivate them? You do that, hopefully, and we're testing this actually in a study we're doing in Dallas, using technology to be able to provide additional instruction that's engaging, which technology allows one to do, and technology which begins to provide that additional time and yet still allow the kids to participate in activities and make sure that the teacher isn't just teaching reading all day.
Do we need to consider, perhaps, instead of the idea of a 6.5 or 7 hour school day and then maybe 1 hour or 2 of homework, do we need to look at lengthening a regular school day and cutting out the homework?
Yeah, you know, we live with a school system that was built over 100 years ago, and it hasn't changed substantially since then. A lot of the alternative education systems that are being developed through charter opportunities, et cetera, are playing with those issues. Kids in school for longer school days, more months of the school year, in essence, because they are addressing the issue that Reed is talking about. They are, in many cases, they're working with children who haven't had the opportunities that other children have to learn language, vocabulary, pre-numeracy skills. So they're trying to replace that. In order to do that, 6 hours isn't enough. And so they're playing with the time in school. They're playing with the number of children in classrooms. But it's really important to note that none of these individual variables alone will solve the problem that we have, which is low achievement in many areas of the country.
But I'm glad David said that, because more time, for example, is a magic bullet to many. Smaller class sizes is a magic bullet to many. If we keep doing the same things for a longer period of time or with fewer children that we've always been doing, we're not going to see any difference. Magic bullets are the bane of education and are very, very harmful. And again, just coming back to leadership, principals have to know how to help educate their teachers that this is a magic bullet. don't count on it, and here is the complexity that we have to think about if it's ever going to have a chance of contributing to the kids' education.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. David Chard and Reed Lyon are here, both from SMU. Let's go next to Richardson and speak with Bill. Hello, Bill.
I'm a 31-year-old retired. I taught for 31 years, retired 2 years ago. And I would say the biggest thing that I ran into, and I taught in both DISD and Highland Park, is I was totally unprepared for dealing with parents. And I look back on that now, I mean, for how much time and how professional I needed to be in working with parents, I wish there would have been at least one class taught on how to deal with parents.
And Bill,
I don't mean deal with parents like they were a problem, but sometimes they became a problem because I didn't know what to do.
Bill, before we let you go, I'm assuming that the ways that you dealt with parents in Highland Park tended to be different from the ways that you had to deal with DISD parents.
In many ways, actually, no.
Huh.
Because they both had expectations that the classroom should be designed for their child to succeed.
Yeah, makes
sense. So the parents want the same thing.
Yeah, well, you know, marshaling the support of parents is one of the important secrets of leadership. Is how do you get the community around you to really help in the education of their children? And I mean, this is an area that's full of potholes, because one thing is we want parent involvement. Children spend much more time with their parents than they do in school. And so getting parents to support the kinds of things you're doing in the classroom is critical to your success as a teacher. But in a typical school, you'll have parents who didn't have a good experience themselves in school. They're afraid to come to school, in a sense, so they won't spend time there. You'll have parents who, I'm assuming Bill is talking about, who can be quite demanding about what they want from their classroom teacher or from their school principal. I think this requires a team effort. And it really, this is the kind of thing that many times the public doesn't understand, is that public educators, any educators for that matter, have to spend time outside the classroom in the community, being part of the community and, in essence, trying to create support for the school beyond the school day. And it's one of the toughest jobs. And I think when you have teachers that, you know, typically teachers in the United States historically have been middle class Anglo women. And in many cases, you will see schools in communities where there's a very different kind of population in the community. And there's a cultural misalignment, if you will, between the teachers in the school and the parents in the community, which makes that effort to build community support for the school even greater. And it's absolutely fundamental to making a school successful, is to have that community and parental support.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Bill for a great question. What he was facing and what any educator faces is that everybody's an expert in education.
That's true.
They went to school.
Journalism, too.
Yeah. You know, they went to school. They know how to teach kids better than anybody else because they live with them. I think David is exactly right. It does take a team effort, but there's probably something that Bill could have learned in terms of working with parents when he was in his preparation, and that is helping people understand what his job is. I mean, this whole conversation we're having today is wonderful because I still don't think people know the depth and the complexity of what Bill had to do in the classroom and what leaders and principals have to do. People really don't understand what that job is. And if that's explained, then enlisting parental support might be a little bit easier because they understand that their youngster is front and center in terms of that teacher wanting to serve their needs, but this is the context in which they do it. And, you know, this doesn't have to be someone given a job description. This can be at a PTA or whatever, conversationally saying, these are the kinds of things we're doing. These are the kinds of things it takes. This is the amount of time it takes. I just want you to know this because your youngsters and I are operating in this environment, and this is what we do.
Given that we sort of set the curriculum and then give it to schools and say this is what you will teach, does the sort of operational infrastructure of the typical public school district allow principals adequate flexibility to change things the way they have this great idea, but it's just there's no time for it, or there's no way for them to massage the way things are done?
That's a great question. I actually have not met an effective principal who can't figure out how to do that. Really effective leaders are people who look at their timetable, their schedule, and do not fall into the trap of saying, I can't figure out how to fit this into a school day. And there are lots of examples of this, teaching reading, which we often talk about because Reed and I have backgrounds in that area. We find people will say, well, we teach reading and language arts for an hour and a half or 2 hours a day. I don't have time to fit in content area instruction. Well, in fact, content area instruction of any type requires reading instruction. So that's when a good leader will say, my content area teachers in a middle school, for example, have to be really strong reading teachers. They have to understand how individuals read content area text, and they have to constantly be coaching youngsters to figure out how to use their reading strategies and skills to be a good reader of historical documents, of scientific documents. So it goes along with that professional development and thinking flexibly about how you use time in a school. And time is often the variable that people will talk about the most. As any profession, we're trying to fit a lot into a very small period of the day.
Would it help to enact a practice by which we not only test children to see what they know, say, at the beginning of a school year, but to give them some kind of test that identifies early on for the teacher exactly how they learn?
Well, yes and no. Yes, we have very good instruments, particularly for young kids, to predict at kindergarten and first grade, for example, who's going to have a tough time reading. We do that pretty well. David's also an expert in mathematics. He'll have to say whether we have the same capability. Once we identify youngsters who are at risk, clearly we know we can probably prevent a full-blown problem. Now, what is that going to take? It's going to take a teacher that knows what they're doing, but it's also going to take an understanding that to teach reading requires certain components and...
You've got 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, whether or not... Yes, how children learn, the teacher needs to know that, but the teacher needs to know what she's teaching and how best to get it across. But that's a complex subject. Maybe I can return to it.
Absolutely. Right after the break, we have Reed Lyon and David Chard here from the Simmons School of Education at SMU. You can join the discussion at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today about the impact of leadership on effective education in public schools with David Chard, who is Dean of the Annette Caldwell Simmons School of Education and Human Development at SMU, and Reed Lyon, who is Distinguished Professor of Educational Policy and Leadership at SMU. And Reed, before the break, you were talking about the limitations of sort of testing for learning style.
Testing for learning styles is not the best use of time if those learning styles are these global kinds of characterizations like auditory learner or kinesthetic learner or visual learner and so forth. Those kinds of labels don't help us understand which instruction is most effective at all. What we know is how reading develops, for example. We know what goes into it, so teachers have to know that to teach it. But it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. The best instruction is instruction that say, if you're the teacher, you're assessing that youngster very rapidly and quickly and continuously. You know exactly when the instruction is not having an effect, and then you adjust that instruction. And you may do that 6 times in the first 6 weeks. That is the hallmark of a good teacher, to be able to differentiate instruction, and it's the hallmark of a good leader to make sure their teachers aren't going off on these magic bullet kinds of things, right brain, left brain, and so on.
Are good teachers made or born?
Some good teachers are born, but I think it's important to know that good teachers, as well as good educational leaders, have to be made. They have to understand. And partly I say that, Chris, because as teachers, we don't work one. It's not a Helen Keller situation where we're working with one child all the time. There are people who obviously do that kind of clinical work with struggling learners. But for the most part, we work in a system. And the system requires certain kinds of skills and knowledge and aptitudes that have to be taught, have to be developed so that people can be successful in very complex environments that we think are pretty natural because we've all been through them, schools. But, you know, putting one person in front of 30 children and expecting world-class outcomes is a very challenging thing to expect. And so we have to really prepare them for it.
Do we need to give principals more freedom to replace teachers who are not doing what they need to do, even if they're good people and even if they're trying hard?
Yes, absolutely. A principal is operating in a complex organizational environment with an immense amount of responsibility and accountability. And the biggest accountability factor is to help kids learn and achieve. And if that is the business of the day, and that business is not being done expertly and appropriately, let's cut to the chase. The kids are simply not learning or achieving. Identify the factors that are responsible for that. And if one of the factors is a teacher, I am sure there are stages one goes through to make sure the teacher has the right professional development and is shown very clearly the kinds of things that he or she could learn to do more effectively. But after those particular kinds of procedures, there has to be the strength to say this is not the place for you.
Yeah, I'm glad Reed clarified by saying, you know, we need to make sure we have processes in place to make sure they're getting the kind of support they need. But it's really critical to understand that one bad school year in a child's career can set the trajectory in the wrong direction for that child, just like one really good school year can change the trajectory. And I think we have to be mindful of the fact that we're working, again, with very complex issues, working with children and trying to help them learn and develop socially, et cetera. And we want to make sure we get the best teachers in front of them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, few issues. One, it seems like a little absurd that we kick everybody out of these schools with the last few hours of the day, and we pay and subsidize the daycare for them, and maybe that could be voluntary. Also, all the information on writing and reading is that student-centered teaching is good, but we demand express lesson plans, which don't seem to allow much flexibility. And also, student teachers, why can't we pay student teachers minimum wage? And we could probably then extend that student teaching period. But, you know, an adolescent is someone who can't support themselves by one definition. And yet, so all these student teachers are adolescents, and they can't, you know, I was told that you couldn't have a job while you're student teaching, and yet you have to pay tuition for the privilege. And those are seem like a few things that could be changed, and they're contradictory.
Thomas, you've given us a lot to chew on, so let's
sure.
see if we can get a response. Thanks.
Well, I think many of the things Thomas talking about are related to the system that we take for sort of granted, that the way it is the way it always has to be. And many of the things he's talking about are already being employed. Longer school days, children staying in school longer. We now have data that says that children in the middle grades and high school, for example, who are out of school by 3 or 4 o'clock often get in trouble because they're unsupervised. So we're finding a lot more after-school programs and that are structured and motivating and interesting and in many cases academic and focused on improving children's academic achievement as well. I think, you know, we're also seeing alternative means of getting teachers into classrooms, student teachers, and making it an easier pathway for them. Teach for America is a great example, which has now come to Dallas. And and gives young people, bright young people, a means of getting into education and exploring whether or not it's the right career for them. So I think he raises a lot of good issues, and I think we have to – the more we think about is the old system the right way of accomplishing what we want, the more we'll find this experimentation and lots of good things happening as a result.
Yeah, and David's exactly right. And one of the things that you've seen change with the accountability movement, which could be a lightning rod or whatever, but one good thing that we're watching happen is now the focus is on outcomes, not process. And David talked about the processes that are in place. If we focus on outcomes, this sounds overly simplistic, but our energies are then devoted to understanding very clearly the role that student teachers might play in improving student outcomes, the role that teacher-centered or learner-centered instruction plays in those outcomes. We've come at education from, in a sense, a belief world. I believe this, I believe this. My philosophy is this, my philosophy is that. If you are looking at how well the kid's doing, then we get evidence as to whether student teachers need to have this. Why? Because the kid benefits from it. Why the teacher needs to be teacher-centered for this kid? Why? Because the kid learns better. Stay on the kid. The kid is where it's at.
I am not an expert on education, although I have four children. But the one thing that really surprises me, and David, you mentioned the fact that middle school and high school students who get out too early get in trouble. There seems to be so much evidence to say that they would learn much better starting a little later in the morning and going a little later. It is I can't understand why every school district in the country has not made aggressive moves to shift the time of that school day.
Well, this is actually a fascinating topic to me because it's about our culture and society. I mean, public education, in addition to preparing informed citizenry, which obviously is necessary for democracy, is also a place that allows parents to go to work. And honestly, I think it's just that simple. If we shift the timetable, we then cause a situation where children aren't supervised in the morning. And while probably is a better time for them not to be supervised because many of them are still waking up, I think it puts a burden on the public to figure out how do I then manage that situation. And we do see some school districts who have done this and believe that it's contributed to – it's not the only contribution, but it has contributed to improved achievement and certainly a reduction in rates of juvenile delinquency and other issues. So,
our email address is think@kera.org. We hear now from Dean in Wiley, who asks, is age-based structure the best for teaching, or would a personality-based broad age range per class be better? In other words, do all six-year-olds need to be in kindergarten, or should we move that around?
I'll answer this. I'm sure Reed has a response as well. Again, traditional structure, age-based structure. We've seen parents and educators experiment with this over the years in different ways. There's nothing to say that an age-based structure is the best way to handle things. It's an efficiency system, which is what our public education system is really built to do. As many children in one place so that it's affordable as a tax-paying country. I think we've seen some experimentation to show that children in the early grades who have a broader band can sometimes help their social development as well as take advantage of some children who are a little further along than others. When you get to the high school level, we see a lot more mixing of ages. We should, because we know that some children who are in eighth grade, for example, are performing like a high schooler in many content areas. The question is, should you institutionalize it that you have? I think we don't have an easy answer to that. It's likely that it will be more costly if you institutionalize that, and then that's a question of political will.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and then we have to see where the rubber meets the road. Everything comes back to if we change the system or leave the system, it's still how are the kids going to improve? Mm-hmm. So even if we change the system, we are back to a leadership issue that if you have 6 and 7 and 8 year olds in a common classroom, What does that teacher know about managing the classroom, about making sure that, again, it's not overly simplistic, how each youngster requires differentiated or customized instruction at times? It's just going to make it maybe a little more complex if you got 6 to 8 year olds. But when we're talking about the age-based structure, we're talking about process. And I keep trying to remind my students that it is about product, albeit once you see what the product is, then you can manipulate the process to see how we can really improve the product.
Reed, in writing about how we should educate educational leaders, one of the things that you're really concerned about is that a lot of these programs take place in the evenings and there's adjunct professors coming in who may not have the same standards as people who are sort of based in a university. Would there be an advantage to requiring educators who are going back to gain more education to move into administration, requiring them to do this full time for at least some of that time?
I think the research is out with respect to when they come to school. The research is in terms of what they need to receive and give no matter what the time. Mm-hmm. David talked earlier about the need to bring together listening to people quack away or be lectured to in class and then what you do with the information. What we know is we can prepare really good leaders if their information is current and accurate, if they're provided that. We can prepare very effective leaders if they take what they have been given the night before and apply it immediately under guided conditions. And we prepare good leaders, no matter if it's in the evening or in the daytime, if we make sure that we measure how well they're doing so we can help them adjust when we see very quickly if they're not getting the concept and applying it. That doesn't respect time. Now, the issue when you have these folks coming in at night, they've had a full day. They're not as alert as one would be when I teach at night. I'm certainly not. In the best of all worlds, would I want full-time students all the time? I would say yes.
I guess neither one of you is going to give us any magic bullets, but the last thing I want to talk briefly about is money, because many people assume that if there is one magic bullet, it is, in a perfect world, doubling or tripling the amount of money that we spend on educating our children. What do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I believe that educating children well is costly, and we know that as a country, we are often, as I mentioned, looking for efficiencies in anything we spend as a public. The healthcare debate is a great example of that. And I think that in public education, we have for many, many years been satisfied with the efficiency model because we didn't have standards. Now we have standards. Now we have something to look at about whether or not we're being effective. And whether we're being effective, and when we know we're not being effective, we can look for a number of ways to solve that problem. Most of them are going to be more costly than the efficiency model we've lived with in the past. And this isn't to say that in some ways it depends on what those outcomes are you're interested in. If you want to provide world-class academic outcomes, as well as all the kinds of entertainment and motivation and social outcomes that we expect schools to do for children, it's going to cost more than we typically think school should cost.
David Chard is Dean of SMU's Annette Caldwell Simmons School of Education and Human Development. Reed Lyon is Distinguished Professor of Educational Policy and Leadership at SMU. Guys, it's been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.